So it's 1969, the Apollo moon landing. Neil Armstrong is outside the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module. Neil Armstrong is descending the ladder and he's about to take his first step. He looks at the lunar dust and notices how powdery it is. Then he steps off the ladder and his boots touch the moon's surface, and Neil Armstrong suddenly disappears beneath the surface, sinking down, down into the lunar dust. Well, that didn't happen, of course. But it was a possibility that had to be seriously considered by Professor Brian O'Brien. Professor O'Brien is an Australian scientist who was closely involved in the Apollo missions, and one of his jobs was to analyse the sticky dust that lies on the moon, and which got into just about every part of the spacecraft, as it happens. All this week, the ABC is focusing on stargazing, on astronomy, stars and planets, and so today we're bringing you this conversation with Brian O'Brien about his long life in science, his career with NASA, and about the moment when he was almost given up for dead as he lay deep within a cave network, lost in complete darkness. But that comes later. I began by asking Brian O'Brien about the nature of moon dust. What's it actually like?
It's very, very fine, like talcum powder, but it's as coarse and cutting as sandpaper, only much worse.
Is it like asbestos fibre then, is it? A bit like
No. It's individual grains, which are thinner than a human hair, is to get it into perspective. But they've been bombarded by meteorites and the rest for 4,000 million years on the surface of the moon. So it's been pulverized into finer and finer powder. But the trick about it is, what makes it particularly nasty, is about half of it's sand, much the same as on Earth. So if you think of sand, think of it as glass, for example. You know how sharp the edge of broken glass is? Well, a micrometeorite hitting that is traveling so fast, 25 kilometres a second or something, it'll penetrate right through, it'll melt it, and the melt of the glass will then stick to the next piece of dust. So you have these all accumulate as all these savage little teeth, if you like, sharp teeth.
So it's like dirty, tiny, shattered glass, in other words.
Worse than that. It's very, very fine. Its toxic properties on the astronauts are still being explored. But it cuts into everything, it sticks onto everything. That's the worst part of it. And the lack of atmosphere in the moon and the small gravity and the fact that the sun is shining, or the raw sun is shining, you get all the dust particles get charged up. And so they interact and they stick to anything and everything. They stuck to the astronauts, they stuck to the astronaut suit, so they were carried back inside the space cabin and so on.
When did you raise this as a potential issue for the Apollo missions?
Well, this was actually one of the weirdest aspects. NASA had intended, once they decided to go to the moon, Kennedy decided, 61, in 64 or so, they advertised for scientific experiments to be part of a scientific observatory that the astronauts would put on the moon each time, to send radio signals back to Earth so that the measurements of the moon would continue for years after the astronauts left. And they had 90 proposals, and they picked 7 of those. Amongst the 7, they picked mine to measure auroral electrons and protons and things in space. Nothing to do with dust. And I heard them give their presentations out in L.A., all very serious stuff. The 7 principal investigators were the kings, if you like. And they kept on talking about dust, but nobody knew anything about it. And I thought it made common sense, at least on the first mission, to measure this stuff and measure whether, when the astronauts took off in the lunar module, the jet exhausts stirred up the dust and blew it all over my experiment and turned its beautiful white and gold exterior into dirty sort of grey, which would overheat. And they all sort of more or less agreed that dust was a problem, but nobody proposed to measure it. So I was fairly cranky, as I was young and cranky as you get. And on the plane flying back from LA to Houston just before dinner, I invented a dust detector, and I made it as small as I could. It's only about an inch square, about the size of a matchbox. Drew the first design on the back of the coaster that came with the scotch, and I refined it on the coaster that on the white napkin that came with the nuts.
Those coasters and napkins are responsible for a lot of creativity in this world, aren't they?
Yeah, they sure are. So I proposed it to NASA, and somehow or other it went. Flew on Apollo 11, was successful. It found what I thought might happen. And so it flew on 12 and 13, 14 and 15.
What did you find from your dust detector once it went on those missions?
Well, on Apollo 11, the astronauts didn't have too much spare time. So the idea was just to drop the experiment fairly close to the lunar module, only 17 meters away, and then get on with their work. And when they took off, the rocket exhaust did indeed throw up dust and debris. It did indeed contaminate the one other experiment that was left, which overheated, and it carked it after about 21 days. And the dust detector measured by how much this happened and so on.
Did you feel vindicated after that?
I felt vindicated, but I didn't want to tell people too much about it because the Apollo 11 experiment in toto was such a magnificent venture, and I didn't want to rain on anybody's parade, you know.
What happened to all that dust that got into the lunar module? And did it come? It came back to Earth with the astronauts themselves.
Yep. They dusted it off as best they could. On Apollo 12, where they spent longer on the moon, the two astronauts in the lunar module were so dirty and dusty that the command module pilot said, "It looks like a dirty coal mine down there in the lunar module." And so they had to strip naked and come in new.
It's a fascinating thought for me that the nature of the dust of the moon is because of so much violent activity. Because if I've got a picture of the moon, I'm imagining the Sea of Tranquility,
right,
where nothing ever happens. Stuff that does happen, but over a very, very long time.
Well, this is the fascination of lunar dust, which was still not resolved. The moon, everyone thinks, is dead, you know, inert. But the little dust particles come to life as soon as the sunlight, the raw ultraviolet and X-rays of the sunlight, they knock by what's called the photoelectron effect. They've got so much energy, they punch electrons out of the dust particles, so that's a negative charge, leaving each one positively charged.
So what do they do? Do they wiggle then, do they?
They sort of, well, we don't really know, and that's what I've been measuring. They move around a bit. They talk to each other. They may talk to massive electric fields, which are caused by the moon being bombarded by plasma from the sun and various other things. So I'm not quite certain just how active they are as yet. There is a school of thought which says that they actually levitate up to 50 kilometres or so above the moon. Yay, verily.
But there's a theory that there's a cloud of dust at 50 km, what's orbiting
at sunrise, the moon. At sunrise and sunset.
It goes up and then comes down again?
That's what the theorists say.
Why did you read so many books when you were a little boy?
I was alone and I liked reading.
Why couldn't you go to school?
Well, I had various childhood illnesses. Asthma and whooping cough and pneumonia and a few things like that. So I didn't go to school until I was about 10. But I had the advantage of having an older brother, Terry, 2 years older, and he went to school, so I could read his homework and things like that. And Dad had a library of a couple hundred books, so I just worked my way through them.
There's been an often stated correlation on this program between high achievers and childhood convalescence. It happens all the time. Oh, yeah. Kids go through a period where they're sick and for whatever reason, whether it's polio or for whatever they have, and have to stay in bed. They get a bit blue, get a bit depressed because they're stuck inside while all the kids are playing.
Yep.
But they read a lot and they think a lot and they figure out who they are. Is that overstating it, Brian, or did you do a lot of self-examination when you were?
No, the self-examination came when I got lost in the cave.
I want to come to that soon. We're not missing that. Why was Harry Messel such an important figure in your education?
Because of his enthusiasm and because he brought a fresh excitement to science that had never been seen in Australia, and also because he was very kind and he got me a scholarship so that I could afford to do an honours year. And then when I got first class honours, he got me another scholarship so that I could afford to do a PhD.
Why physics of the sciences? Well,
physics is the prince of science.
It's the prince of sciences?
Oh, yes.
All right, every biologist in Australia is picking up the phone right now.
Well, that's fine. Biology has its place.
Well, that's kind of you to say that about them. Tell me when Harry Messel, your mentor, it's fair to call him a mentor, isn't it?
Oh, sure.
Called you with a strange request involving polar bears.
Well, Harry and I had been together on and off over the years after I left there. And I was sitting in the office at Rush University in Houston with half a dozen of my engineers who were helping me build the big experiment, the suitcase, the briefcase-sized experiment for Apollo. It was Friday morning, and Harry called, and I didn't know where he was calling from. He always called weird places. And he just said to me, Brian, and he didn't need to introduce himself. He's got a distinctive voice that resonates. Brian, I want to know if I can track polar bears from a plane. And so I sort of talked to him a little and did some calculations and said, yeah, I think I can. You can. After I asked him how high the plane was and things like that. And he said, good, I'll go and tell the governor. And I said, what'll you tell the governor? Who's the governor? He said, oh, governor of Alaska. I'll tell him that we'll do the project. And I said, what's the project? He says, tracking polar bears around the pole, because nobody knew how many there were, nobody knew how to conserve them, and so on and so on. Because polar bears, because they're independent of countries, all the countries bordering on the Arctic can't control the polar bears. The only degree of control at the time was that there was a license. You could kill one polar bear in your lifetime for a fee of $1,000. I don't know who got the $1,000, but still. So I told him that, hang on, you can't see the governor just yet. He said, well, I'm leaving Alaska at 3 o'clock, whatever it was, to fly to Japan to see the prince, and which was typical Harry.
Which prince?
Prince over there somewhere in Japan.
Oh, Japanese prince. Oh, yeah. Oh, right.
Sorry.
Okay.
And so I have to leave. And I said, well, give me a few hours. I'll call you back. And so the engineers there, the Apollo engineers, had heard all of this. So we decided we'd put Apollo to one side for the rest of the day. And I gave them all different jobs, or we choose different jobs, and batteries. And
can I just be clear about that? You put aside work on the Apollo mission for a day to help your friend figure out how to track polar bears.
Sure. It was Friday. And so they called up their contacts east and west. It was middle of the day, so the California was alive and the East Coast was still alive. We must have had about 40 engineers working on that. And so I phoned Harry, say, yes, we can, or you can. And I went from there. It got sillier and sillier, but funnier and funnier, really.
Brian, what got you interested in cave exploration?
Probably the reading of Castro's books. My dad had a couple of his books in the library that I read as a kid. And I was quite fascinated there. And then I heard at university that there was a speleological society, Sydney University Speleological Society. And I met them in orientation week, I guess. And they invited me down to Bungonia Cave, to the Drum Cave. And because I was the lightest in the party, I was first over, sort of thing. 140 feet straight down, your introduction to the cave. And it just all happened from there on. I loved it.
Tell me what the appeal is for anyone listening who's even vaguely claustrophobic. It sounds nightmarish. What is the appeal of cave exploration?
Mixed. It's first of all that you go where you can go where no one has been before. But when you get there, if you're lucky, you find beautiful crystalline, sparkling crystalline grottos and formations that nobody's seen before. And they're much richer and alive than what you see in a tourist cave. Tourist caves dry out, sort of thing.
So it fires the imagination. It's otherworldly.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep. Total darkness, total silence. And so you lost two of your senses there straight away. And it's just remarkable.
How did you get lost?
Carelessness and excitement at finding another grotto.
What were the circumstances?
Well, Fred Stewart, who was my old mate, he and I had gone caving for, well, several years by then, many caves. And we were reconnoitering. This was the second cave we'd reconnoitered that day. And the entrance to it, at East Deep Creek, they're unexplored. Nobody had been in them. Was a mass of fallen rocks. The old roof had fallen in many times. So it's, think of a three-dimensional maze with rocks ranging from, you know, boulder size up to house size type stuff, with holes in between them. And it was a case of finding a way through there. And I found my way through into a cavern at the bottom of which was this beautiful grotto sparkling in the light that I had. But I got separated. Well, Fred and I always separated in order to explore. But he was out of contact. And
what do you mean he was out of contact? What, you shouted out?
Shouted out and couldn't hear anything. And then tried to find my way out and couldn't. And then I was climbing over a cliff, about a 12-foot cliff, to get down. I put the spike of my carbide lamp in the roof. I'd turned down the light by that stage. It was just a little bubble of light to prolong the life. And I fell and couldn't reach the lamp, of course. So I took off my boiler suit and held it by a leg and waved the arms to knock it down. And all I did, of course, was extinguish the light, which didn't particularly help. So I was without any light. I had a few matches. I set a light to the I had a little tassel on my beret. Set a light to that with one of the matches and sort of regrouped and then proceeded to try to find my way out because I didn't know if Fred had got out. That was a real crunch. There's two types of being lost. Being lost if somebody knows you're lost and is looking for you, and there's lost without people looking for you. I thought I fell in the second category.
Were you trying hard to suppress a rising sense of panic?
No, I don't think I was panicked. I don't think I ever panicked. I got depressed about part of the way through when I got stuck.
Yeah, that's about as bad as as it can get in many ways. But then things actually got worse. How did they get worse? How did you get stuck?
Well, the only way I could try to find a way out in the dark, so it's darkness and silence, right? And there are nasty deep holes around you, potentially, is sit on my bottom and scout around for a rock, throw a hand over my boots, and if I heard it fall, I could go forward that way. If there was silence for a while, you clearly wouldn't go in that direction. So I'd rotate my boots, find another rock, and throw it then. And I kept doing that for some time.
You'd never get out.
Oh, yes, you would.
In perfect darkness,
yeah.
Inching along on your backside,
yep.
Proceeding, then picking up little rocks, throwing them.
I had nothing and but then when time,
you,
Richard.
And then when you, yeah. Well, you didn't have a lot of time, did you? I mean, only so many days you can survive under those circumstances.
Well, it was moist. And, you can live for a week or two.
And when you threw the pebble, occasionally did you hear a sort of go,
no, it doesn't go.
No, I know.
Total silence, and then 1 second later or 2 seconds later, which is too long.
Donk.
Worst one is not a single donk. The worst one is when you hear donk, and then a little later you hear a second donk. That's the scary one.
Not going down that way. Time to swivel. So there you are in perfect darkness, somewhere underground, in a maze of caves.
No, not a maze, just a maze of rocks.
Maze of rocks.
With tunnels and passages sort of where the river had been.
Even worse, actually. Okay, maze of tunnels and rocks. And you're inching yourself forward. You can't hear your friend. You don't know where he is, if he's lost or if he's got out, or right. He even knows you're lost, or he can even alert anyone to the fact that you've gone missing. And then you got stuck. How did you get stuck?
It was in an area where it was starting to slope down, and the roof just came closer and closer and closer. And I thought, you know, there was no way to throw a rock ahead. I had to. Well, I was just stuck.
Stuck? What, your foot got stuck?
Well, not stuck. I could still move everything. But the roof came too close to my nose and my boots.
So what did you do?
I scratched the last will and testament in a few letters above my head.
With what?
Just a rock, another rock, sharp rock.
In darkness. You're writing your will.
It's a very brief, just an occasional letter. And then I decided I wouldn't die just yet and started going backwards.
Did you ever tell anyone what you wrote in that?
No.
Do you remember what you wrote?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I wonder if it's got any legal force now. It'd be pretty hard to go and find it, wouldn't it?
It'd be hard to find, yeah.
Professor Brian O'Brien is my guest in conversation, an outstanding Australian physicist who was deeply involved in the Apollo missions onto the moon, and we'll come back to those shortly. How did you get out? How were you rescued from this dire, dire state?
A few of the boys came down, a few of the Spelios cave explorers came from Cooma and from Sydney University and wherever. And the police, Fred had got to the cave's house and had alerted people. And this was Snowy Mountains country, so all the Snowy Mountains bushmen rallied, if you like. They'd heard from the cult from Old Regret.
Got away. Stuck in so a tunnel somewhere, writing his will with a stone on a ledge.
So all the bushmen came in and
gathered to the fray.
And yeah, they searched the bush, and the cave explorers searched the cave. And fortunately, the police were about to give it up after 2 days, apparently. But Dad and Fred persuaded them to go for a third day, and they found me on the third day.
Can you paint a picture of what it was like for you then to hear human contact in this dire position, Brian?
I was vaguely relieved.
Yeah. Well, how did it come to you? Well, tell me what you saw or heard.
No, I didn't. I heard. I kept on. I won't do it over the microphone, but there is a call of cave explorers and bushwalkers, which is very penetrating. And I was doing that from time to time. I wasn't sort of just sitting and twiddling my thumbs. And I do that whenever. It was very cold as well. It was only 40 degrees Fahrenheit, so a few degrees centigrade. So I was shivering like Billy O. But I heard a sound and called back. And one of the Cooma guys said, "O'Brien, is that you?" Which I thought was rather, Dr. Livingston, yeah. I believe.
No.
So we went from there.
Princess Grace of Monaco, you know.
And so I joined up with him, and they'd laid a paper trail in, and we got lost on the way out, which was rather interesting. But then I went there, got out, said hello to Fred, and one of those Snowy Mountain guys, they had campfires, which was very welcome, and he boiled me this Billy tea that was as strong, as much sugar as he could pour into it. And I still remember he gave me a slice of his wife's fruitcake, and it was absolutely glorious. And I got on the back, or tried to get on the back of the horse. That's when I found out for the first time how weak I was. I found it hard to swing my leg over. But then he took me up on the back of the horse, and everything happened from there.
How long were you in that cave for?
I think it was 79 hours or something like that.
3 days.
3 days, yeah.
Very few of us will ever experience that kind of trial of the spirit. What did you do when you were trapped all that time? It's like being in solitary confinement.
Well, it's worse because if you're in solitary confinement, somebody knows they put you in solitary confinement.
How did you stop yourself from cracking up? How did you keep yourself entertained?
I was lucky that I'd read a lot of books and knew a lot of poetry and had favourite music and so on. So I just mentally went through all of those, and it's amazing what you can recall.
Use the old internal iPod, did you? Tell me how you met your wife, Avril.
I met her in a cave, actually, Jenolan Caves. She was an undergraduate, first-year undergraduate, and they were doing a geology expedition, and I was leading this mob of speleos up there, and we met.
Is it difficult to be the partner of the wife of a scientist such as yourself, who's always taking off to places like Antarctica and inside caves? And
Well, you got to put it in perspective. She's done very well herself. She used to either have a baby or win a degree when I was building satellites in Iowa, for example. She got more degrees than I've got. But, yes, it is difficult. The physics department at Iowa, for example, had what is called Physics Wives Association. And there are only 9 professors there. There's Van Allen and myself. We're the only 2 professors in space science, but lots of, a couple of hundred graduates. And so the physics wives were to advise the graduate student wives how to live with a space scientist. And as Avril said, you know, she had no other experience. We'd only been married a year or something. So, yes, apparently it is difficult.
Brian, why did you want to go to Antarctica? What did you want to see there?
Well, again, it comes back to the books. I'd read about the Antarctic and I loved the thought of it, the exotic nature of it. Once I got my PhD in Sydney, University of Sydney, I wanted a job somewhere and I found a job with the Antarctic Division in Melbourne. I was deputy chief physicist, built a photometer, a device to measure light from auroras. Went down the Antarctic down in the 58-59 expedition to take over the American base at Wilkes, which is now Davis.
What was the science behind your trip to Antarctica?
To try to understand what caused auroras.
They were still mysterious to us then, were they, in the 50s? These beautiful curtains of coloured light.
Divine signalling is what Robert Scott called it, and it really is. I would recommend to any of your listeners, whether young or old, go see a bright aurora, and particularly try and see one in the Antarctic. Not the Arctic so much, but the Antarctic.
Why? Why Antarctic rather than Arctic? What's better about the south than the north?
It's the absence of land and the dominance of the purity of the colours and the purity of the whiteness and the panorama and so on. It just, you know, even in moonlight particularly, the auroras are bright enough to see and they're dancing all over, scintillating all over the sky, moving in magic colours. It's just something you should experience.
What causes the aurora?
Well, we didn't know then. We had a clue that it was caused by electrons spiralling down the Earth's magnetic field lines. Think of them as 2 halos around the North Pole and South Pole, and then striking the atmosphere, striking the oxygen and nitrogen about 100 and a few hundred kilometres high in the atmosphere, and cause it to glow, much the same as the old TV screens glowed when you fired a beam of electrons at them. But we didn't understand what caused the shapes, we didn't understand what powered it, the electrons and so on. I saw my first aurora about 2 o'clock one morning, clinging to the wire rails of the Magadan icebreaker, which was bucking all over the place. And I was just blown out of my mind by this thing, and there was no way I was going to point my little photometer. It was just too overwhelming. That year, there'd been the first American satellites flown, SEP 58, and I decided that I'd put a satellite 1,000 kilometres up to look down at the light and then put particle detectors, Geiger counters and things like that.
That's an extraordinary thought, isn't it? You know what, I'm going to make a satellite.
Well, it was the only way to get above the auroras. I mean, it was clear we knew enough. The auroras were happening mainly at 100 kilometres, 200 kilometres. So you had to get above them, and with a satellite to live reasonably long, you need about 1,000 kilometres. And then it's just cause and effect. You point a photometer down to measure the light, and you measure put particle detectors out sideways and up to measure the particles that are causing the light.
What does the aurora look like from space then, when you're looking back down on the Earth?
About the same, but not as impressive.
Looks like an algal bloom, doesn't it? It looks.
Oh, cut it out. That's nasty. It looks like 2 white halos around the Earth, but it's much better looked at from the Earth.
You and Avril got married and moved to the United States and went to Iowa. What was in Iowa for you?
Jim Van Allen, Professor Van Allen, he and his team built the first 4 American satellites and discovered the radiation belts that were given his name. In fact, he was on Time magazine the month or so after I accepted the job.
So you were in very much the right place at the right time.
Yep.
This is after Sputnik, isn't it? And, and the Eisenhower administration just had to suddenly play catch-up very, very quickly. A whole lot of money and research and energy was suddenly available for space.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but it was a space race was on, there's no doubt about that. But Eisenhower in particular didn't want it to be a military mission. That's why the Americans went first. Eisenhower didn't like the military building a satellite which would then spy in people's backyards. That was the thinking going on.
He's a fascinating man, Eisenhower.
I always thought that was a gorgeous sort of peaceful thought for the man that ran D-Day invasion.
And who left office warning of the military-industrial complex, which he worried would bankrupt the United States.
And who believed that Berlin was no longer of any political importance, yes.
What were you learning at the time about the solar wind?
Theorists had said it had to be there. Solar wind is the atmosphere of the sun. Sun very, very hot, so it boils off the gases, if you like. Electrons and protons, which are called plasma, and they boil off supersonically at speeds of 300 kilometres a second, something like that, right outwards, right through the solar system. And so when they meet the Earth, they meet the magnetic field of the Earth about 100,000 kilometres out, and that forms a shock wave forms around that, and that throws back the magnetic field lines of the Earth into the tail, what's called the magnetotail. Now, this can be simplified if you think of comets. Everyone knows comet tail points away from the sun, and for years we were taught that that's because of the pressure of sunlight. It's not. It's caused by the blowing plasma of the solar wind, which is blowing in the same direction as sunlight, obviously. But that plucks the magnetic field lines and tosses them back in a great long tail. And that tail can extend to the moon, can wag across the moon for a few times around about full moon. This long tail of the Earth wags across the moon. And at the bottom end, at the Earth end, in two little halos above each magnetic pole, the auroras occur. So the particles sort of communicate all the way along.
You're doing all this interesting, fascinating research in Iowa, and then the Pentagon called, despite Dwight D. Eisenhower's misgivings, they called you in 1961. What did they propose to you?
They said, we've got a classified payload going up 29th of June. There's room in the nose cone for another payload 13 inches high, weighing no more than 40 pounds. Can you use it? And Van knew what I wanted to do, so he came to me, we talked it over, and we said, yay.
I love that. The Pentagon ring and say, g'day, mate, we've got 13 inches of a nose cone available for you. What do you want to put in it?
Well, funnier things happened than then.
So what did you put in there?
Put in Engine 1, the satellite that I dreamed of in the Antarctic. It had a photometer to look down at auroras, and it had particle detectors, and I put a bar magnet to tilt it along the magnetic field lines of the Earth. And nobody had done that before, but makes sense. So think of it as a little compass needle inside the cylinder of engine, and you just tilt that keeps the cylinder oriented along the magnetic field line, so it points down over the poles.
These are amazing times, aren't they, where you can hatch fantastic schemes.
Great fun, yep.
Tell me about the launch and firing up this little box of yours.
Well, the launch was Cape Canaveral, but it was classified. We weren't allowed to tell anyone that we were there. I stayed back in Iowa because with Engine 1, I wanted to save power, and so I commanded it on and off, not to continuously transmit the way that Sputniks and the other ones did, but to save power and only transmit when it was over a receiving station. And so the first receiving station was Iowa, and I heard that the boys told me it was launched, and so I commanded it on, or requested it to be on, and then this little signal came down, which was great. And it lasted more than a year, which was a world record at the time.
Meanwhile, the Soviet Union and the United States were setting off nuclear explosions in space. We've forgotten about this time, but they were actually conducting nuclear tests in space.
Right.
That also staggers the imagination as well. For a start, it would make no sound at all as a nuclear explosion would go off in space. Right. Tell me about those and how they affected the satellites of the time.
Well, this wasn't sort of my bomb is bigger than your bomb sort of thing. This was quite important militarily. In order for the Americans to see if the Russians were firing a nuclear missile at them, they had to use radar. The radar had to go through the ionosphere above the American bases to see the incoming one. The question then arises whether you should blow up the Russians as soon as you detect it near you. But if you do that, does the blast so change the ionosphere that your radar can't get through and you can't see the second one coming? The alternative is to blow it up over the Russians. But if you do that, you have to launch before the Russians launch, which is an act of war. So you really need to know, how does the ionosphere, upper atmosphere, which transmits radio waves and radar and whatever, how does it change if you blow an atomic bomb or nuclear devices at high altitude? And so the Russians and the Americans were doing that. And the biggest one was Starfish in July the 9th, 1962. It was 1.4 megaton. That's 70 times bigger than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. It was quite a big device. It was exploded 400 kilometers above Johnston Island in the Pacific. I thought it would blow the top off the magnetosphere and really muck things up, and it did.
It temporarily blew a hole in our magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I don't like the thought of hole. It's still just a plasma distortion, really. I mean, the field comes back. But it injected all these high energy electrons, fission electrons, which then travelled along the magnetic field lines, which then drifted around the Earth and made an artificial radiation belt encircling the Earth. They then caused radiation damage in the solar power supplies of 7 satellites, and so the satellites stopped operating. The only one that kept on operating was Little Engine 1.
So the detonation of this bomb then winked out all these satellites, but yours survived. Why? Why did yours survive?
Because I built it with cheap solar cells. They were already 6% efficient, and they're as degraded as you could get. And I did that to save money, and also because I wanted to use them for temperature control of the satellite.
You moved to Rice University in Houston, Texas, and that was connected to the space program. What was the nature of your work there, Brian?
More of the same. A couple of the engineers from Iowa came down with me, and we started off the first space science department in the world, actually, at Rice University. And they built a nice new building for us and whatever.
You were involved in training astronauts. Did that involve the astronauts of the Apollo 11 space mission?
Some of them. Most of the Apollo astronauts, Apollo teams were in that group of 14.
How did they strike you, those men?
Oh, magnificent fellas. The best class I've ever taught in terms of focus and attention and relevant questions. But, you know, they're more or less marched in their boots and so on, regimented when they arrived. They were a mix of people. You know, you had former fighter pilots in there as well. It's not often realised. A lot of those guys had 60 missions in the war and so on.
Lovely men too. I've seen extensive interviews with them in that documentary, The Shadow of the Moon, which is a beautiful documentary. And although I suspect that they were trained not to be hugely imaginative, because you could get caught up in the wonder and the awe of what you're doing and not be focused on the thousands of tasks at hand. But after all these years of reflection, they certainly had all sorts of things to say.
Well, Alan Bean, who was the lunar module pilot on Apollo 12, I'm still in touch with him, and he turned to became an artist. You know, he keeps painting astronauts on the moon and so on.
Did you ever want to go yourself?
I was too tall in the first place.
Now, did you want to go, though?
I wanted to be there. I didn't want to go through all the training. If I could have been sort of hyper lifted, whatever it was, zapped up for the experience, sure. But I couldn't have tolerated the discipline that was needed.
After the Apollo space mission, you came back to Australia after some years in the United States. Yep. Did you always intend to come back?
Yeah, we decided, Avril and I decided, we'd come back before the kids were too old to get established in school and so on. So we came back in 68 when the oldest was 8. We came back a year or two early because 68 was a fairly nasty year in the States with assassinations, and the racial violence was pretty savage, even in Houston. And so there was absolute danger there. And we came back, and I commuted between Sydney and Houston. Harry Messel, my old buddy, organized me to be a visiting scientist there. Harry wanted me for 3 months as a visiting professor after I'd been at Rice University for a year. So we decided then I did Australia-wide lecture tour and so on. We tended to pick Perth, I must admit.
And that's why you took on the job for the Director of Environmental Protection in Perth?
Well, I'd been wanting to move into environments away from space environment for some time. Apollo 13 really highlighted that, the failure of that and the hazards they had. And environment in Australia at that time, this is early 70s, in the eastern states, in New South Wales, Victoria, they thought of it as just being pollution. And as far as I was concerned, environment was the total spaceship Earth, much the same as a satellite. No real difference in the engineering and treating a total systems in a satellite to total systems on spaceship Earth. But you didn't just treat the incidental waste stuff, the pollution stuff. You treated national parks and flora, fauna, humans, urban pressure, population density, the whole kit and caboodle.
What was your first big task as director?
They'd been saving up quite a lot, but the real one that they saved up was to report on a proposed Pacmanex alumina refinery, $300 million refinery in the Swan Valley, which had been approved by both the previous government, the coalition government that appointed me, and the current government, the Labor government, with Premier John Tonkin, who was my minister, and had been approved by Parliament subject to a report once I had the Environmental Protection Authority legislation established. And so, yeah, both governments and Parliament wanted a report. It didn't have to be a favourable report, just a report before the Premier could sign the agreement. And I gave
It was in the legislation that you had to sign off on it?
No. We could go ahead. Clause 7.2 said that the Premier could not sign the agreement until he'd received a report. That's all it said.
Just receive the report?
Yeah.
And what did your report conclude?
Oh, we said it was too damn close to Perth. We had 191 reasons, in addition to that, environmental reasons. It was on top of the Nangara Mound, although we didn't know the existence of the Nangara Mound. It's a freshwater mound that supplies half of Perth's water now. Would have been stuck right on top of that. After a certain amount of argy-bargy, they agreed it wouldn't go ahead.
Were you seen as a hero or a villain, or both I suppose?
Both. Lots of stories there, but one of the proponents for Pacmanex owned half the Sunday Independent, so a fairly substantial portion of the Sunday Independent was devoted to whether or not, you know, I'd pass kindergarten maths and a few things. But it was all good, clean fun. I don't want to leave it in an aggressive sense, because the 70s were superb in Western Australia for the cooperation between governments of both parties, industry, public service, CSIRO, universities, and whatever. I could ask the best people, the experts on anything, to help me, whether it's RAAF or, you know, anything. And we'd all get together for the good of the future. And unfortunately, that whole atmosphere, of course, is gone. The object was facts and alternatives.
Why did a talk you gave to Perth Rotary in 1990 attract a fair bit of attention, Brian?
They asked me to give a talk on climate change. Well, then it was called the greenhouse effect. I'd kept up to it, but I really hadn't sort of dug down. So I spent 3 weeks or so with the fundamental papers and got rather frightened at the exaggerations that were going around. So I gave my first talk there. I gave the title The Greenhouse Effect and the Death of Mark Twain.
Why that title?
Well, Mark Twain said when reading of his death in the headlines that it was somewhat exaggerated. And yet it's got a germ of truth in it. So Avril typed up the notes, and the notes became very popular. And then one of the coal miners asked me to expand on that and write a monograph. And they funded the monograph. No editorial control, complete freedom to expand on the facts because, as they put it, their stockholders needed to know.
What was the situation as you saw it? Were you prepared to accept that climate change was largely man-made or anthropogenic, as it's sometimes called?
No, it was certainly not proven. And so I took on CSIRO and whatever. The sad part was there were no senior scientists who were independent. I was independent because I had my own consultancy on all sorts of things. And I had an established reputation, so I could ask CSIRO to debate with me, as we did in Melbourne, Canberra, all sorts of places, over a satellite link. But the funding for climate change research was only going to what you'd call true believers. When that happens, you inevitably get a bias. And the sad situation, a professor of physics told me, Brian, I completely support what you're saying, but I've got 65 researchers in my laboratory, and the only funding I can get for them and to get their PhDs this greenhouse funding from Canberra or wherever. 20 years people have been indoctrinated with this abusive language. So climate change doesn't mean climate change as common sense would say. You know, climate change, a mix of changes in climate from whatever causes, to the popular community and to the politicians now. Climate change means changes in climate caused primarily by human activities.
So your argument was that the climate is changing, but
This is not... I mean, blind Freddy knows it's changing. We all know that.
That's the science of it. But your argument is that primarily it's changing because of natural factors or factors unrelated to human activity.
It's a mix. The scientific question is what contribution comes because of human activities. Will, for example, the floods in Queensland, which they had in the 1890s, a great Federation drought that they had 1895 to 1902 throughout Australia, will they persist through great natural forces before the artificial greenhouse, man-made greenhouse contributions, modify them?
I suppose anyone listening to who would hear you say things that the funding was going to true believers on this would be thinking, well, that's one way of looking. Another way of looking at it is that just merely reflects the overwhelming scientific consensus that climate change is largely man-made.
No, you've got to be careful. The first Australian policy on climate change, as we call it now, was pulled down by Paul Keating's government in October 1990, and it was to support the Toronto target, which is reduction of greenhouse gases by 20% by the year 2005 to the level that they were in 1990, right? So that's the Toronto target by 20%. Now, that was assumed to be a scientifically derived figure.
Where was that figure?
That figure was derived at a half-day workshop at the Toronto conference in 1988 by about 20 of the scientists, and they said something along the following lines. We want to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide emitted by man. There are two issues. One is the demand for electricity or power. So we want to reduce the demand by, a challenging figure would be 10%. That's fine. And they said, we also want to increase the efficiency with which it's used. And a challenging figure would be to increase the efficiency by 10%. And so you add up 10% efficiency increase and 10% reduction demand, and you've got 20%, and that becomes the Toronto target. But that then became adopted as if it was scientifically backed up, scientifically derived. It was a useful target, but it was plucked from the entrails at Toronto. And CSIRO gradually admitted that that's all it was. But the relevance now, forget about the old days in 1990, the relevance was Paul Keating insisted that Australia could adopt that target, provided our trading partners did likewise. Keating was a sharp cookie, and he was fine about reducing greenhouse emissions by 20%, provided our trading partners do likewise. There is no better summary of the present quandary than that.
Then you're in the old prisoner's dilemma. It's a philosophical problem, isn't it? You go first. No, you go first. No, you go first. No, you go first. And nothing gets done.
Well, that could be, but we could go on at some length about that. It is the prisoner's dilemma, and we're the prisoners. But it was so unnecessary.
When I met you earlier on coming in, before we got into the studio, I said, what an amazing life you've had. And you said, had?
Having, yes. Well, I'm going off to talk to Space Science Forum in California in July, and I expect that to be fireworks.
I'm someone who thinks of the space program as the United States at its absolute best. It's the thing, you know, thousands of years from now, if we're still on this planet, we'll remember the Americans probably for that more than anything.
Yep.
Is it sad and you they've retreated so much from pushing the boundaries of space exploration?
Yes. But I think they'll come back. The Chinese are doing all sorts of things in space. Europe is doing all sorts of things. In terms of the moon, there's Germany and Russia, Japan, China, European Union, and the US and so on. They're all active up there again. But I think what's happened is a bit of the heart has gone out of it as well as the financing. And I can understand that. It happened after Apollo 11, really. Apollo 11 was followed by postpartum blues. Enthusiasm and interest in space more or less passed. It was required Apollo 13 and the near tragedy there to reactivate the interest.
Given how hostile space is to the human body, how everything about us is built to survive and thrive on the planet Earth, do you think ultimately we have a future in space as human beings in space?
You mean somewhere else in
space? Yeah, that's what I mean. Well, on bases that are built, for example, on the moon. Do humans have a future off the surface of the Earth?
I would hope so. But you're talking to a cave explorer. I don't see any limits to the future of humanity if it puts its mind to it sensibly.
On that note, it's only left for me to thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. I've enjoyed it.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Our website is abc.net.au/conversations. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.